I asked about him because... Is he one of the regulators, then? She looked at him curiously, one brow lifted. Of course. Are you not with the regulation yourself? Of course. Here on this side of the Alamance, what else? Tryon's troops were drawn up in good military order on the field beyond the creek. Over here, the regulators swarmed like bees, without leadership or direction, an angry mass buzzing with random violence. No, he said. I've come with the militia. He waved toward the distant smudge where the smoke of Tryon's campfires hung, far beyond the creek. Her eyes grew wary again, but not frightened. He was only one man. That's the thing I wanted to tell you, he said, to warn you and your husband. The governor is serious this time. He's brought organized troops. He's brought cannon. Lots of troops, all armed. He leaned toward her, holding up the rest of the wet stockings. She reached out a hand to take them, but kept her eyes on his, waiting. He means to put down this rebellion by any means necessary. He's given orders to kill if there's resistance. Do you understand? You must tell your husband. Make him leave before anything happens. She paled, and her hand went reflexively to her belly. The wet from the clothes had soaked through her muslin dress, and he saw the small swelling that had been hidden there, round and smooth as a melon under the damp cloth. He felt the jolt of her fear go through him, as though the wet stocking she held conducted electricity. "We did, but not now," she had said, when he asked whether they lived nearby. She might mean only that they had moved to some new place, but there were baby things in her wash. Her son was with her here. Her husband was somewhere in this boiling of men. A single man might pick up his gun and join a mob for no reason beyond drink or boredom. A married man with a child would not. That spoke of serious disaffection, consequential grievance. And to bring both wife and child to war suggested that he had no safe place to leave them. Roger thought it likely that Morag and her husband had no home at all now, and he understood her fear perfectly. If her husband should be maimed or killed, how was she to provide for Jemmy, for the new baby swelling under her skirt? She had no one, no family here to turn to. Except that she did. Though she didn't know it. He gripped her hand hard, pulling her toward him, overcome with the need somehow to protect her and her children. He had saved them once. He could do it again. Morag, he said, hear me. If anything should happen, anything, come to me. If you're in need of anything at all, I'll take care of you. She made no effort to pull away, but searched his face. Her eyes brown and serious, a small frown between those curving brows. He had an irresistible urge to make some physical connection between them, this time for her sake as much as his. He leaned forward and kissed her, very gently. He opened his eyes then, and lifted his head, to find himself looking over her shoulder into the disbelieving face of his many times great-grandfather.
Get away from my wife.
William Buckley Mackenzie emerged from the shrubbery with a great rustling of leaves and a look of sinister intent upon his face. He was a tall man, close to Roger's own height and burly through the shoulders. Further personal details seemed inconsequent, given that he also had a knife. It was still sheathed at his belt, but his hand rested on the hilt in a significant manner. Roger resisted his original impulse, which had been to say,
"It's not what you think."
It wasn't, but there weren't any plausible alternatives to suggest.
"I meant her no disrespect," he said instead, straightening up slowly.
He felt it would be unwise to make any quick moves.
"My apologies." "No, and just what the hell do you mean by it then?"
Mackenzie put a possessive hand on his wife's shoulder, glowering at Roger. She flinched,
Her husband's fingers were digging into her flesh. Roger would have liked to knock the hand away, but that was likely to cause more trouble than he had already. "I met your wife, and you," he added, "on board the Gloriana a year or two ago. When I recognised her here, I thought to inquire as to the family's welfare. That's all."
"He meant nae harm, William."
Morag touched her husband's hand and the painful grip lessened.
"It's right what he says. Do you not ken the man? It was him that found me and Jemmy in the hold when we hid there. He brought us food and water."
"You asked me to care for them," Roger added pointedly. "During the fight, that night when the sealers threw the sick ones into the sea." "Oh, aye."
Mackenzie's features relaxed a trifle.
"That was you, was it? I didn't see your face in the dark." "I didn't see yours either."
He could see it clearly now, and despite the awkwardness of the present circumstances, couldn't help studying it with interest.
So this was the son, unacknowledged, of Dougal Mackenzie, erstwhile war chief of the Mackenzies of Leoch. He looked it. His was a rougher, squarer, fairer version of the family face. But looking carefully, Roger could easily spot the broad cheekbones and high forehead that Jamie Fraser had inherited from his mother's clan. That, and the family height. Mackenzie stood over 6 feet tall, nearly eye to eye with Roger himself. The man turned slightly at a sound in the brush, and the sun lit those eyes with a flash of bright moss green. Roger had a sudden urge to shut his own eyes, lest Mackenzie feel the same bolt of recognition. Mackenzie had other concerns, though. 2 men emerged from the bushes, wary-eyed and grimy with long camping. One held a musket, the other was armed with nothing but a rough club cut from a fallen limb.
"Who's this then, Buck?"
the man with the gun asked, eyeing Roger with some suspicion.
"That's what I mean to be finding out."
The momentary softening had disappeared, leaving Mackenzie's face grimly set. He turned his wife away from him and gave her a small push.
"Go you back to the women, Morag. I'll deal with this fellow."
"But William..."
Morag glanced from Roger to her husband, face drawn in distress.
"He hasn't done anything."
"Oh, you think it's nothing, do you, that a man should cheek up to you in public like a common raj?"
William turned a black look on her and she blushed suddenly crimson, evidently recalling the kiss, but stumbled on.
I mean, that is, he was kind to us. We shouldn't have been..."
"I said, go back."
She opened her mouth as though to protest, then flinched as William made a sudden move in her direction, fist clenched. Without an instant of conscious decision, Roger swung from the waist, his own fist hitting Mackenzie's jaw with a crack that jarred his arm to the elbow. Caught off balance, William staggered and fell to one knee, shaking his head like a pole-axed ox. Morag's gasp was drowned by startled exclamations from the other men. Before he could turn to face them, Roger heard a sound behind him, quiet in itself, but loud enough to chill the blood. The small, cold snick of a hammer drawing back. There was a brief pst of igniting powder, and then a phoom as the gun went off with a roar and a puff of black smoke. Everyone jerked and stumbled with the noise, and Roger found himself struggling in a confused sort of way with one of the other men, both of them coughing and half-deafened. As he shoved his assailant off, he caught sight of Morag kneeling in the leaves, dabbing at her husband's face with a bit of wet laundry. William shoved her roughly away, scrambled to his feet, and headed for Roger, his eyes bulging, face blotched red with fury. Roger spun on his heel, slipping in the leaves, and shook off the grip of the man with the gun, making for the shelter of the bushes. Then he was into the thicket, twigs and small branches splintering around him, raking face and arms as he thrust his way through. A heavy crashing and the huff of breath came just behind him, and a hand fastened on his shoulder with a grip of iron. He seized the hand and twisted hard, hearing a crack of joint and bone. The hand's owner yelled and jerked back, and Roger flung himself headlong toward an opening in the scrub. He hit the ground on one shoulder, half-curled, rolled, broke through a small bush, and tobogganed down a steep clay bank and into the water, where he landed with a splash. Scrabbling to find a foothold, he plunged and coughed and flapped upright, shaking hair and water from his eyes, only to see William Mackenzie poised at the top of the bank above him. Seeing his enemy thus at a disadvantage, Mackenzie launched himself with a whoop. Something like a cannonball crashed into Roger's chest, and he fell back into the water in a mighty splash, hearing the distant shrieks of women. He couldn't breathe and couldn't see, but grappled with the twisting mess of clothes and limbs and roiling mud, churning the bottom as he strove vainly for footing, lungs bursting for air. His head broke the surface. His mouth opened and closed like a fish's, gulping air, and he heard the wheeze of his breath and Mackenzie's too. Mackenzie broke away, floundering, and stood upright a few feet away, wheezing like an engine as water poured from his clothes. Roger bent, chest heaving, hands braced on his thighs and his arms quivering with effort. With a final gulp of air, he straightened, wiping away the wet hair plastered over his face.
"Look," he began, panting. "I..."
He got no further, for Mackenzie, still breathing heavily himself, was advancing on him through the waist-deep water. The man's face had an odd, eager look, and the moss-green eyes were very bright. Belatedly, Roger thought of something else. The man was the son of Dougal Mackenzie, but the son also of Gillis Duncan, witch. Somewhere beyond the willows there was a deep booming noise, and flocks of startled birds rose screeching from the trees. The battle had begun. Chapter 65. Alamance. The governor then sent Captain Malcolm, one of his aides-de-camp, and the Sheriff of Orange, with his letter, requiring the rebels to lay down their arms, surrender up their outlawed ringleaders, and etc. About 10:30, Captain Malcolm and the sheriff returned with the information that the sheriff had read the letter for several times to different divisions of the rebels, who rejected the terms offered with disdain, said they wanted no time to consider them, and with rebellious clamours called out for battle. Journal of the Expedition Against the Insurgents, William Tryon.
"He'll watch for Mackenzie."
Jamie touched Geordie Chisholm's shoulder, and Geordie turned his head, acknowledging the message with a slight nod. All of them knew. They were good lads. They'd be careful. They'd find him, surely, coming back toward them. He told himself so for the dozenth time, but the reassurance rang as hollow this time as it had before. Christ, what had happened to the man? He moved up into the lead, shoving aside the brush with as much violence as though it were a personal enemy. If they were watching out, they'd see Mackenzie in time, not shoot him by mistake. Or so he told himself, knowing perfectly well that in the midst of enemies and the heat of battle, one fired at whatever moved, and there was seldom time to check the features of a man who came at you out of the smoke. Not that it would make so much difference who did for Mackenzie, if anyone did. Brianna and Claire would hold him responsible for the man's life, and rightly so. Then, to his relief, there was no more time to think. They broke out into open ground, and the men spread out and ran, bending low, zigzagging through the grass in threes and fours as he had taught them, one seasoned soldier to each group. Somewhere behind them, the first boom of cannon came like thunder from a sunny sky. He spotted the first of the regulators then, a group of men, running, as they were, coming from the right across the open ground. They hadn't seen his men yet. Before they could, he bellowed and charged them, musket raised overhead in signal to the men behind him. Roars and shrieks split the air, and the regulators, startled and taken unawares, stumbled to an untidy halt, fumbling their weapons and interfering with each other.
"To me! To me!"
Close enough. It was close enough. He dropped to one knee, crouched over the musket, brought it to bear, and fired just over the heads of the milling men. Behind him he heard the grunt of his men falling into firing order, the clink of flint, and the deafening noise of the volley. One or two of the regulators crouched, returning fire. The rest broke and ran for cover toward a small rise of grassy ground.
"Left! Cut them off!"
he heard himself bellowing, but did it without thought, already running himself. The small group of regulators split, a few making off toward the creek, the rest bunching like sheep, galloping for the shelter of the rise. They made it, disappearing around the curve of the hill, and Jamie called his troops back with a piercing whistle that would carry over the rising thunder of the guns. He could hear firing now, a rattle of muskets away to their left. He sheered off in that direction, trusting that they would follow. A mistake. The land here was marshy, full of boggy holes and clinging mud. He shouted and waved again, back toward the higher ground. Fall back there. Let the enemy come to them across the bog, if they would. The high ground was heavy with brush, but dry at least. He spread his fingers wide and waved, gesturing the men to spread out, take cover. The blood was pumping through his veins and his skin prickled and tingled with it. A puff of grey-white smoke drifted through the nearby trees, acrid with the scent of black powder. The boom of artillery was regular now, as the gun crews fell into their rhythm, thumping like a huge, slow heart in the distance. He made his way slowly toward the west, keeping an eye out. The brush here was mostly sumac and redbud, with waist-high tangles of bramble and clumps of pine that rose above his head. Visibility was poor, but he would hear anyone coming long before he saw them, or they saw him. None of his own men were in sight. He took cover in a stand of dogwood and gave a sharp call like a bobwhite quail. Similar calls of bobwhite came from behind him, none in front. Good, they knew roughly where one another were. Cautiously he went forward, pressing through the brush. It was cooler here with the shade of the trees, but the air was thick and sweat ran down his neck and back. He heard the thump of feet and pressed back into the branches of a hemlock, letting the dark needled fans swing over him, his musket raised to sight on an opening in the bushes. Whoever it was coming fast. A crack of snapping twigs underfoot and the sound of laboured breath, and a young man shoved through the shrubbery, panting. He had no gun, but a skinning knife glinted in his hand. The lad was familiar. The first glance gave him that. And Jamie's memory put a name to the young man's face before his finger had relaxed upon the trigger. "Hugh," he called, low-voiced but sharp. "Hugh Fowles." The young man let out a startled yelp and swung round, staring. He saw Jamie and his gun through the screen of needles and froze like a rabbit. Then a surge of panicked determination rose in his face and he launched himself toward Jamie, screaming. Startled, Jamie barely got his musket up in time to catch the knife blade on its barrel. He forced the knife up and back. It sheared down the barrel with a screech of metal glancing off Jamie's knuckles. Young Hugh whipped back his arm for a stab and he kicked the boy briskly in the knee, stepping back out of the way as the lad lost his balance and lurched to one side, knife swinging wildly. Jamie kicked him again, and he fell down, the knife embedding itself in the ground.
"Will you stop that?" Jamie said, rather crossly. "For Christ's sake, lad, do you not know me?"
He couldn't tell whether Fowles knew him or not, nor even whether the boy had heard him. Face white and eyes staring, Fowles was thrashing in a panic, stumbling and gasping as he tried to get up, trying at the same time to wrench his knife free.
"Will you?"
Jamie began, and then jerked back as Fowles abandoned the knife and threw himself forward with a grunt of effort. The boy's weight knocked Jamie backward, and hands scrabbled at him, trying for a grip on his throat. He dropped the musket, turned a shoulder into Fowles's grip, and put a stop to this nonsense with a quick, brutal punch to the lad's midsection. Hugh Fowles collapsed and lay curled into a ball on the ground, twitching like a wounded centipede, and making the shocked, breathless faces of a man whose breakfast has just been knocked up into his lungs. Jamie put his right hand to his mouth, sucking blood from his grazed knuckles. The boy's knife had skinned all four, and the punch hadn't helped. They burned like fire, and the blood had the taste of hot silver in his mouth. More feet, coming fast. He had barely time to seize his musket before the bushes burst open once more, this time to reveal Fowles's father-in-law, Joe Hobson, his own musket held at the ready.
"Stop right there!"
Jamie crouched behind his gun, training the muzzle on Hobson's chest. Hobson halted, as though a puppet master had jerked his strings.
"What have you done to him?"
Hobson's eyes flicked from Jamie to his son-in-law and back.
"Nothing permanent. Put your gun down, eh?"
Hobson didn't move. He was grimed with filth and sprouting beard, but the eyes were live and watchful in his face.
"I mean you nae harm. Set it down. We'll not be taken," Hobson said.
His finger rested on the trigger of his gun, but there was a dubious note in his voice.
"You already are, fool. Dinna fash yourself. Nae harm will come to you or the lad. You're a deal safer in jail and out here, man."
A whistling crash punctuated this statement as something flew through the trees a few feet overhead, shearing branches as it went.
"Chain shot," Jamie thought automatically, even as he ducked in reflex, bowels clenched.
Hobson jerked in terror, swinging the barrel of his musket toward Jamie. He jerked again, and his eyes went wide with surprise as a red stain flowered slowly on his breast. He looked down at it in puzzlement, the muzzle of his gun drooping like a wilted stem. Then he dropped the gun, sat down quite suddenly, leaned back against a fallen tree, and died. Jamie whirled on his heel, still squatting, and saw Geordie Chisholm behind him, face half black with the smoke of his shot, looking at Hobson's body as though wondering just how that had happened. The boom of artillery came again, and another missile crashed through the branches and landed nearby with a thud Jamie felt through the soles of his boots. He flung himself flat on his belly and writhed towards Hugh Fowles, who had got himself up on hands and knees now, retching. He grabbed Fowles' arm, disregarding the pool of vomit, and jerked hard.
"Come on!"
He scrambled up, seizing Fowles by waist and shoulder, and dragged him toward the shelter of the copse behind them.
"Geordie! Geordie, help me!"
Chisholm was there. Between them they got Fowles onto his feet and half-dragged, half-carried him, running and stumbling as they went. The air was filled with the pungent scent of tree sap oozing from the severed branches, and he thought fleetingly of Claire's garden. Churned earth beneath his boots, the fresh turned earth of furrows and graves. And Hobson, sitting in the sun by the log, the look of surprise not yet gone from his eyes. Fowles stank of vomit and shit. He hoped it was Fowles. He thought he would vomit himself from sheer nerves, but bit his tongue, tasting blood again, and clenched the muscles of his belly, willing his wame to go back down. Someone rose from the shrubbery to his left. He held the gun in his left hand, raised it by reflex, fired one-handed. He stumbled through his own smoke, seeing whoever he had fired at turn and run, smashing heedless through the trees. Fowles had his feet back under him now, and Jamie let go his arm, leaving Geordie to it. He fell to one knee, groping for powder and shot, ripped the cartridge with his teeth, and tasted gunpowder tinged with blood, poured and rammed home, filling his priming pan, checked his flint, all the while noticing with a sense of bemusement that his hands were not shaking in the least, but went about their business with a deft calm, as though they knew just what to do. He raised the barrel and bared his teeth, only half conscious of doing it. There were men coming, three, and he raised the gun to bear on the first. With a last shred of conscious thought, he jerked it higher and fired above their heads, the musket jolting in his hands. They stopped, and he dropped the gun, ripped the dirk from his belt, and charged them, screaming. The words seared his throat, raw from the smoke.
"Run!"
As though from a distance, he watched himself, thinking it was just so that Fowles had done, and he had thought it foolish then.
"Run!"
The men scattered like fleeing quail. As a wolf might do, he turned at once after the slowest, bounding over the broken ground, a ferocious joy flooding his legs, blooming in his belly. He could run forever, the wind cold on his skin and shrill in his ears, the spring of the earth beneath him lifting his feet so he flew over grass and rock. The man he pursued heard him coming, glanced back over his shoulder, and with a shriek of terror ran full tilt into a tree. He threw himself upon his prey, landing on the man's back, and feeling the springy crack of ribs beneath his knee. He gripped a handful of hair, slick and hot with greasy sweat, and jerked back the man's head. He barely stopped himself, cutting the naked throat that lay before him, stretched and defenceless. He could feel the shock of the blade on flesh, the hotness of the spurting blood, and wanted it. He gulped air, panting. Very slowly, he drew the knife away from the leaping pulse. The movement left him trembling with need, as though he'd been dragged from his woman's body on the verge of spilling seed.
"You are my prisoner," he said.
The man stared up at him, uncomprehending. The man was weeping, tears making tracks through the dirt on his face, and trying to speak, sobbing, but unable to draw enough air to make words with his head wrenched back. Vaguely, it occurred to Jamie that he had spoken in Gaelic. The man didn't understand. Slowly, he loosened his grip, made himself release the man's head. He groped for the English words buried somewhere under the bloodlust that pulsed through his brain.
"You are my prisoner," he managed at last, panting for air between words. "Yes, yes, anything. Don't kill me, please, don't kill me."
The man huddled under him, sobbing, hands clasped to the back of his neck, and shoulders hunched round his ears as though he feared Jamie would seize his neck in his teeth and snap his spine. At the thought, he felt a dim desire to do so, but the thrum of his blood was even now dying down. He could hear again, as his heartbeat faded in his ears. The wind no longer sang to him, but made its own way, heedless and alone, through the leaves above. There was a popping of distant gunshots, but the boom of the artillery had ceased. Sweat dripped from chin and eyebrows, and his shirt was sodden with it, reeking. He slid slowly off his prisoner and knelt beside the prone body. The muscles of his thighs trembled and burned from the effort of the chase. He felt a sudden, inexpressible tenderness for the man, and reached to touch him. But the feeling was succeeded by a sense of horror, quite as sudden, and as suddenly gone. He closed his eyes and swallowed, feeling sick, the place where he had bitten his tongue throbbing. The energy the earth had lent him was draining from his body now, flowing out of his legs, going back to the earth. He reached out and patted the prisoner's shoulder, awkwardly, then struggled to his feet against the dead weight of his own exhaustion.
"Get up," he said.
His hands were shaking. It took 3 tries to sheath his dirk.
"Camara how, McDo?"
Ronnie Sinclair was at his side, asking if he were all right. He nodded and stood back as Sinclair pulled the man to his feet and made him turn his coat. The others were coming, in ones and twos, Geordie, the Lindsays, Gallagher, catching up and clustering round him like iron filings drawn to a bit of magnet steel. The others had bagged prisoners too, 6 in all, looking sullen, frightened, or simply exhausted, their coats turned lining out to show their status. Fowles was among them, white and wretched. His mind had cleared now, though his body felt limp and heavy. Henry Gallagher had a bloody graze across his forehead. One of the men from Brownsville, Lionel was it, carried one arm at an awkward angle, obviously broken. Bar that, no one seemed to be injured. That was good.
"Ask if they've seen Mackenzie," he said to Kenny Lindsay in Gaelic, with a small gesture toward the prisoners.
The gunshots had mostly ceased. There was only a random firing now, and a flock of doves passed overhead in a racket of wings, belatedly alarmed. None had seen Roger Mackenzie to know him. Jamie nodded, hearing, and wiped the last of the sweat from his face with his sleeve.
"Either he has come back safe, or he has not. But whatever's done is done now. You've done brawly, lads. Let's go."
Chapter 66. A Necessary Sacrifice. This evening, the dead were interred with military honours, and 3 outlaws taken in the battle were hanged at the head of the army. This gave great satisfaction to the men, and at this time it was a necessary sacrifice to appease the murmurings of the troops, who were importunate that public justice should be immediately executed against some of the outlaws that were taken in the action, and in opposing of whom they had braved so many dangers and suffered such loss of lives and blood. A Journal of the Expedition Against the Insurgents, William Tryon. Roger jerked hard at the rope round his wrists, but succeeded only in digging the rough hemp farther into his flesh. He could feel the burn of a braided skin, and a damp feel that he thought was oozing blood, but his hands had gone so numb that he wasn't sure. His fingers felt the size of sausages, the skin stretched tight. He was lying where Buckley and his friends had thrown him after tying his wrists and ankles, in the shade of a fallen log. Soaked through from the river, he would have been shivering with cold had he not been struggling so desperately to get loose. Instead, sweat ran down his neck, his cheeks burned, and he felt as though his head would burst from the influx of furious blood. They'd gagged him with the flag of truce, stuffing the kerchief so deep into his throat that he was close to choking, and knotting his own stock round his mouth. Ancestor or no, he was going to mangle William Buckley Mackenzie if it was the last thing he ever did. Shots were still being fired nearby. Not in volleys, but a ragged popcorn rattle. The air reeked with black powder smoke, and every so often something came whistling through the trees like a jabberwock, with a tremendous ripping and snapping of branches and leaves. Chain shot. Cannonballs. A cannonball had thudded into the riverbank earlier, burying itself in a small explosion of mud and momentarily interrupting the fight. One of Buckley's friends had uttered a cry and run, splashing for the shelter of the trees, but the other had stayed, grappling and punching, heedless of the shooting and yelling, until he and Buckley had managed to press Roger's head beneath the water and overpower him. He could still feel the burn of the river water in his sinuses. He'd managed to get to his knees now, hunched like an inchworm, but didn't dare to raise his head above the log for fear of having it shot off. Fury was running so strong through his veins that he hadn't really been frightened, even at the realization that the battle was going on round him. But he hadn't lost his mind entirely. He rubbed his face hard against the crumbling bark of the log, trying to snag the strip of linen tied round his head. It worked. The stub of a twig caught, and he jerked his head up, pulling the stock down below his chin. Grunting with the effort, he shoved the wadded kerchief out a little way, caught it on the same twig, and drew back, the soggy rag pulling out of his throat like a snake swallower in reverse. He gagged with reaction, feeling bile rise up the back of his throat. He gulped air, greedy for oxygen, and his stomach settled a bit. Great, he could breathe. Now what? The firing was still going on, and he could hear crashing off to his left as several men ploughed through the bushes, heedless of obstruction. Running feet were coming toward him. He ducked behind the shelter of the log just in time to avoid being flattened as a body catapulted over it. His new companion scrambled up onto hands and knees, pressing tight against the log, only then becoming aware of his presence.
You...
It was Blackbeard from Husband's Encampment. He stared at Roger, face suffusing slowly with blood. He could smell the man, a rank penetrating reek of fear and anger. Blackbeard grabbed him by the shirt front, jerking him close.
This is your fault, bastard.
With his hands and feet still tied, he had no means of fighting back, but jerked back, trying to free himself.
Let go, fool.
Only then did the man realise that he was tied, and in his astonishment did let go. Off balance, Roger fell to the side, scraping his face painfully on the rough bark of the log. Blackbeard's eyes bulged with amazement, then narrowed in glee.
By dad, you've been captured. If that ain't luck, who's got you, fool?
He's mine.
A low Scottish voice behind him announced the return of William Buckley Mackenzie.
What do you mean it's his fault?
What is? This!
Blackbeard flung out an arm, indicating the field around them and the dying battle. The artillery had ceased, and there were no more than scattered rifle shots in the distance.
This damn smooth talker come into the camp this morning asking for Herman husband and took him away for private word. I don't know what in desolation's name he said, but when he finished it, husband come out, got straight onto his horse, told us all to go home and rode off.
Blackbeard glared at Roger and, drawing back his hand, slapped him hard across the face.
What did you say to him, arse bite?
Without waiting for an answer, he turned back to Buccleuch, who was glancing back and forth between his captive and his visitor, a look of deep interest furrowing the thick, fair brows.
"If Herman had stuck with us, we might have stood," Blackbeard raged. "But with him going off like that, it cut the ground right from under us. Wasn't no one knew quite what to do. And the next thing you know, there's Tryon a-bawling surrender at us. And of course we wasn't going to do that. But we wasn't what you'd call prepared to fight, neither."
He trailed off at this, catching Roger's eye on him, and uncomfortably aware that Roger had seen him fleeing in panic. There was nothing but silence on the far side of the log. All firing had stopped. It was dawning on Roger that the battle was not only over, but well and truly lost. Which meant, in turn, that the militia were likely to be swarming over this place in short order. His eyes were still watering from the slap, but he blinked them clear, glaring at Blackbeard.
"I said to husband what I see to you," he said, with as much authority as he could muster, lying trussed on the ground like a Christmas goose. "The governor is serious. He means to put down this rebellion. And by the looks of things, he's done just that. If you have a care for your skin, and I'd say you do."
With an inarticulate growl of rage, Blackbeard seized Roger by the shoulders and tried to smash his head into the log. Roger twisted like an eel. He reared back, breaking the man's grip, then threw himself forward and butted the man squarely, smashing Blackbeard's nose with his forehead. He felt the satisfying crunch of bone and cartilage, and the spurt of blood hot and wet against his face, and fell back onto one elbow, panting. He'd not given anyone a Glasgow kiss before, but it seemed to come natural. The jar of it hurt his wrist badly, but he was beyond caring. Just let Buccleuch come close enough to get the same, that's all he wanted. Buccleuch eyed him with a mixture of amusement and wary respect.
"Oh, a man of talent, I. A traitor, a wife-stealer, and a bonny brawler. All in the same wee bundle, is it?"
Blackbeard threw up, choking on the blood from his crushed nose, but Roger paid no attention. His vision clear now, he kept his eyes square on Buccleuch. He knew which man of the two was the greater threat.
"A man who's sure of his wife needn't worry that someone else might steal her," he said, anger only slightly tempered with wariness. "I'm sure of my own wife, and have no need of yours, Amadine."
Buccleuch was sunburned and deeply flushed from fighting, but at this a darker red crept into his cheeks. Still he kept his composure, smiling lightly.
"Married, are you? Your wife must be ill-fevered, surely, for you to be sniffing after mine. Or is it only that she's put you out of her bed because you couldna serve her decently?"
The rasp of the rope on his wrists reminded Roger that he was in no position to bandy words. With an effort, he bit back the retort that sat on the tip of his tongue and swallowed it. It tasted foul going down.
"Unless you mean your wife to be a widow, I think it's time you were going, aye," he said.
He jerked his head toward the far side of the log, where the brief silence had been succeeded by the distant sound of voices.
"The battle's over. Your cause is lost. I don't know if they mean to take prisoners." "They've taken several."
Buccleuch frowned at him, clearly undecided. There weren't that many options, Roger thought. Buccleuch must let him go, leave him tied, or kill him. Either of the first two was acceptable. As for the third, surely if Buccleuch meant to kill him, he'd be already dead.
"You'd best go while you can," Roger suggested. "Your wife will be worried."
It was a mistake to have mentioned Morag again. Buccleuch's face grew darker, but before he could say anything, he was interrupted by the appearance of the woman herself, in company with the man who had helped Buccleuch tie him earlier.
"Well,
Oh, Willie, thank Christ you're safe. Are you hurt at all?
She was pale and anxious and had a small child in her arms clinging monkey-like to her neck. Despite the burden, she reached out a hand to touch her husband, to assure herself that he was indeed unharmed.
"Then afash yourself, Morag," Buccleuch said gruffly. "I've taken no harm."
Still, he patted her hand and kissed her self-consciously on the forehead. Ignoring this tender reunion, Buccleuch's companion prodded Roger interestedly in the side with the toe of his boot.
"What shall we do with this, then, Buck?"
Buccleuch hesitated, his attention drawn momentarily from his wife. Morag, spotting Roger on the ground, uttered a muffled scream and clapped her hand across her mouth.
"What have you done, Willie?" she cried. "Let him go, for Bright's sake."
"I shan't. He's a damned traitor."
Buccleuch's mouth set in a grim line, obviously displeased that his wife's taking notice of Roger.
"He's not. He can't be."
Clutching her son tightly to her, Morag stooped to peer at Roger, an anxious crease between her brows. Seeing the state of his hands, she gasped and turned indignantly to her husband.
"Well, how can you treat this man so, and after he's done such service to your own wife and bairn?"
"For God's sake, Morag, back off," Roger thought, seeing Buckley's fist clench suddenly. Buccleuch was plainly a jealous bastard to start with, and being on the losing side of the battle just past was doing his temper no good at all. "Bugger off, Morag," said Buccleuch, echoing Roger's sentiment in less gallant language. "This is no place for you or the bairn. Take him and go."
Blackbeard had recovered slightly by this time and loomed up alongside Buccleuch. He glared down at Roger, hands pressed tenderly to his swollen nose.
"Slit his throat, I say. Good riddance."
He emphasised this opinion with a kick in the ribs that curled Roger up like a shrimp. Morag uttered a fierce cry and kicked Blackbeard in the shin.
"Let him alone!"
Blackbeard, taken off guard, let out a yelp and hopped backward. Buccleuch's other companion appeared to find this more than funny, but stifled his hilarity when Buccleuch turned an awful glare on him. Morag was on her knees, her small belt knife in her hand, trying one-handed to cut the bonds about Roger's wrists. Much as he appreciated her intent, Roger wished she wouldn't try to help him. It was all too apparent that the original green-eyed monster had firm possession of the soul of William Buccleuch Mackenzie and was glaring out of his eye sockets in an emerald fury.
This ends Disc 29. A Fiery Cross, Disc 30.
Buccleuch seized his wife by the arm and jerked her to her feet. The baby, startled, began to shriek.
"Leave, Morag," Buccleuch snarled. "Go, and go now." "Yes, go," Blackbeard put in, glowering. "We've no need of your help, you interfering little bism." "Don't you speak to my wife that way."
Turning on his heel, Buccleuch punched Blackbeard swiftly in the stomach. The man sat down hard, his mouth opening and closing in comical astonishment. Roger could almost feel a certain sympathy for Blackbeard, who appeared to be faring no better between the two Mackenzies than he was himself. Buccleuch's other friend, who'd been observing the exchange with the fascination of someone watching a close tennis match, seized the opportunity to join the conversation, butting in as Morag tried to soothe her baby's crying.
"Whatever you mean to do, Buck, best we do it and be gone."
He nodded toward the creek, uneasy. There were a number of men coming in their direction, judging from the rumble of voices. Not fleeing regulators. It was a purposeful sound. Militia coming in search of prisoners? Roger sincerely hoped so.
"Aye."
Buccleuch glanced in the direction of the noises, then turned to his wife. He took her by the shoulders, but gently.
"Go, Morag. I'd have you safe."
She heard the note of pleading in his voice, and her face softened. Still, she looked from her husband to Roger, who was now trying mental telepathy, beaming thoughts at her in increasing desperation.
"Leave, for God's sake, woman, before you get me killed."
Morag turned back to her husband, small jaw set in determination. I'll go. But you swear to me, William Buckley, that you will not harm one hair of this man's head. Buckley's eyes bulged slightly and his hands curled into fists. But Morag stood her ground, small and fierce. Swear it, she said. For by the name of bride, I'll not share the bed of a murderer. Clearly torn, Buckley glanced from the sullen Blackbeard to his other friend, who was shuffling from one foot to the other like a man in urgent need of a privy. The party of militia was getting closer. Then he looked down into his wife's face.
All right, Morag, he said gruffly.
He gave her a small push.
Go now.
No. She reached out and took her husband's hand, pulling it toward her breast. Little Jemmy had got over his alarm and was curled into his mother's shoulder, noisily sucking his thumb. Morag placed his father's hand on the little boy's head. Swear on your son's head, Will, that you'll not hurt this man, nor see him killed. Roger mentally applauded the gesture, but was afraid she'd gone too far. Buckley stiffened for a moment, and the blood rose in his face again. After a tense moment, though, he nodded once.
I swear, he said quietly,
and let his hand fall. Morag's face eased, and without a word, she turned then and hurried away, the baby held close to her bosom. Roger let out the breath he'd been holding.
God, what a woman!
He hoped passionately that she and her baby would be safe, though if her fat-headed husband chose to step in a gopher hole and break his neck. William Buckley was looking down at him, green eyes narrowed in contemplation, ignoring the increasing agitation of his friend.
Come on, Buck!
The man glanced over his shoulder toward the creek, where loud calls to and fro indicated searchers combing the ground.
There's no time to be lost. They did say Tryon means to hang prisoners, and I've no mind to be one. Does he?
Buckley said softly. He held Roger's eyes with his, and Roger thought for a moment that something familiar stirred in those depths. A chill of unease ran down his spine.
He's right, he said to Buckley, with a jerk of the head towards the other man. Go. I'll not speak against you, for your wife's sake.
Buckley pursed his lips slightly, thinking.
No, he said at last. I dinna think you will. Speak against me, that is.
He stooped and picked up the sodden, dirt-smeared X-flag of truce from the ground.
Go along with you, Johnny. See to Morag. I'll meet you later. But, Buck, go, I'm safe enough.
With a faint smile, his eyes still on Roger, Buckley put his hand in his pouch and drew out a small bit of dull silver metal. With a small shock, Roger recognised his own militia badge, the crudely lettered FC burned black in the pewter disc. Tossing the badge lightly in his palm, Buckley turned to Blackbeard, who was taking a suddenly renewed interest in the proceedings.
Have a thought, sir, regarding our mutual friend?
He nodded toward Roger.
If you're with me.
Blackbeard looked at Roger, back at Mackenzie, and a slow smile began to grow beneath his bulbous, reddened nose. The ripple of unease down Roger's back blossomed suddenly into a full-blown jolt of fear.
Help! He roared. Help, militia! Help!
He rolled, twisting to avoid them, but Blackbeard seized him by the shoulders, pulling him back. Calls came from beyond the trees and the sound of feet beginning to run.
No, sir, said William Buckley, kneeling down in front of him.
He seized Roger's jaw in a grip of iron, strangling his yells and squeezing his cheeks to force open his mouth.
I do not think you'll speak indeed.
With a slight smile, he rammed the sodden cloth down Roger's throat again and tied the tattered neckcloth fast around it. He stood up then, the militia badge held tight in his hand. As the bushes opened, he turned toward them and waved an arm in hearty greeting. Chapter 67 Aftermath.
It now being 2:30, the enemy entirely dispersed, and the army 5 miles from camp,
It was thought advisable to lose no time but to return immediately to the camp at Alamance. Empty wagons were ordered from the camp, which took both the killed and wounded of the Loyalists, and even several of the wounded rebels, who acknowledged, had they gained the day, no quarter would have been given but to such as would have turned Regulators. These were nevertheless taken good care of, and had their wounds dressed. A Journal of the Expedition Against the Insurgents. William Tryon. A musket ball had shattered David Wingate's elbow. Bad luck. Had it struck an inch higher, it would have broken the bone, but healed cleanly. I'd opened the joint with a semicircular incision across the outer aspect, and dug out both the flattened ball and several bone chips. But the cartilage was badly damaged, and the biceps tendon had been sheared through completely. I could see the silvery gleam of one end hiding deep in the dark red meat of the muscle. I gnawed my lower lip, considering. If I left matters as they were, the arm would be permanently and badly crippled. If I could reattach the severed tendon and bring the bone ends in the joint capsule into good alignment, he might just possibly regain some use of it. I glanced round the campsite, which now resembled an ambulance depot, littered with bodies, equipment, and blood-stained bandages. Most of the bodies were moving, thank God, if only to curse or moan. One man had been dead when his friends brought him in. He lay quiet in the shade of a tree, wrapped in his blanket. Most of the injuries I saw had been slight, though there were two men shot through the body. I could do nothing for them but keep them warm and hope for the best. Brianna was checking them every few minutes for signs of shock and fever, in between rounds of administering honeyed water to those suffering more superficial wounds. Best she kept busy, I thought. And she did keep moving, though her face looked like one of the wild morning glories on the vine that climbed the bush behind me, white and puckered, pinched tight closed against the terrors of the day. I had had to amputate a leg soon after the battle ended. It was a man from Mercer's company, camped near to us, and lacking a surgeon of their own, struck by a rebounding chunk of a mortar that had torn off most of his foot and left the flesh of the lower leg hanging in ribbons from the shattered bone. I'd thought she would faint when the heavy limb thumped into the dirt at her feet, and she'd thought so too, but had by some miracle stayed upright, supporting the patient, who really had fainted, thank the Lord for small mercies, while I cauterized the bleeding vessels and bound the stump with brutal speed. Jamie was gone. He had brought back his men, hugged me hard and kissed me once, fiercely, then left with the Lindsays to take the prisoners to the governor and inquire along the way for any news of Roger. Relief at Jamie's return buoyed my heart, but fear for Roger was a small, heavy counterweight below my breastbone. I could ignore it while I worked, though. No news was good news for a short time yet, and I welcomed the immediate realities of triage and treatment as a refuge from imagination. Nothing else looked exigent. Men were still straggling in, but Bree looked up at each one, her heart in her eyes. If any of them needed me, she would call. All right, I decided. There was time. I'd try it. There was little to lose, bar a bit more suffering for Mr. Wingate, and I would ask if he were willing. He was wax pale and sweating, but still upright. He nodded his permission, and I gave him the whiskey bottle again. He applied it to his mouth with his sound hand as though it contained the elixir of life. I called one of the other men to hold his arm steady while I worked, and swiftly incised the skin just above the bend of the elbow in an inverted T, exposing the lower head of the biceps and making the site more accessible. I began to probe with my longest forceps, teasing out the tough silver strand of the sheared tendon, pulling it down as far as I could, until I had a sound spot where I could pierce it with a suture and set about the delicate work of rejoining the severed ends. I lost touch then with everything around me, all my attention focused on the problem before me. I was dimly conscious of the pit, pit, pit of drops striking the ground at my feet, but didn't know whether it was the sweat that ran down my arms and face, the patient's oozing blood, or both. I could have used the hands of a trained surgical nurse to help, but didn't have them, so made do with my own. I had a fine surgeon's needle, though, and thin, boiled silk sutures. The stitches showed small and neat, a stark black zigzag that marked a sturdy hold on the slippery, gleaming tissue. I would normally have used the catgut sutures for internal work like this, as those would gradually dissolve and be absorbed by the body. Tendons healed so slowly, though, if at all, that I couldn't risk that. The silk stitches would simply stay permanently in place, and I prayed would cause no problems of their own. Then the hard part was done, and time started again. I was able to talk soothingly to David, who had come through it gallantly. He nodded and made a feeble attempt to smile when I told him it was done, though his teeth were clenched and his cheeks wet with tears. He screamed when I washed the wounds with diluted alcohol. They always did. They couldn't help it, poor things. But then sagged back, trembling, while I stitched the surgical incisions and bandaged the wounds. That took no great skill, though. I had attention to spare now, and gradually became aware that some of the men behind me were discussing the recent battle, full of praise for Governor Tryon. "Did you see it, then?" one was asking eagerly. "Did he really do as they said?" "Hope I may be gutted and fried for breakfast if it ain't so," his companion replied sententiously. "Saw with my own eyes, didn't I? He rode up within 100 yards of the swine and ordered them face to face to surrender. They wasn't much answer for a minute, only them kind of looking to and fro amongst themselves to see who might speak. And then somebody shouts out that, 'No, damn it all, they ain't a-going to surrender, nohow.' So the governor, he's a-scowling fit to fright a thundercloud, and he rears up and lifts his sword high, and then brings it down and shouts, 'Fire on them!'" "And did they do so straight off?" "No, we didn't," put in another voice, more educated and rather dry in tone. "Do you blame us? A 40-shilling bounty for joining the militia is one thing, but to fire in cold blood on folk you know is something else. I looked across, and who should I see on the other side but my wife's own cousin grinning back at me? Now, I'm not saying that the rascal is any great favourite with me or the family, but how am I to go home and tell my Sally as I've just shot her cousin Millard full of holes?" "Better than cousin Millard doing the same service by you," said the first voice with an audible grin. And the third man laughed. "True enough," he said. "But we didn't wait to see if it might come to that. The governor, he went red as a turkey cock when the men there with him hesitated. He stood up in his stirrups, with his sword held on high, glared round at us all, and he hollered out, 'Fire, goddamn you! Fire on them or on me!'" The narrator put a good deal of enthusiasm into this reenactment, and there was a murmur of admiration from his hearers. "Now there's a soldier for you," said one voice, followed by a general rumble of agreement. "So we fired," said the narrator, a faint shrug in his voice. "Didn't take so long once it started." "Cousin Millard is right fast, it seems, once he started running. Bastard got clean away." More laughter at this, and I smiled, patting David's shoulder. He was listening, too, the conversation a welcome distraction. "No, sir," another agreed. "I reckon Tryon means to make sure of his victory this time. Heard he's gone to hang the leaders of the regulation on the field."
"He what?"
I whirled round at this, bandage still in hand. The small group of men blinked up at me, surprised.
"Yes, ma'am," said one man with an awkward tug at the brim of his hat. "A fellow from Lillington's brigade told me so. He was off to see the fun." "Fun," muttered another of the men and crossed himself.
"Shame if he hangs the Quaker,"
another opined, face shadowed.
"Old husband's a right terror in print, but he ain't a ruffian, nor a James Hunter or Ninian Hamilton." "Perhaps he'll hang Cousin Millard," another suggested, nudging his neighbour with a grin. "Then you'll be rid of him and your wife can blame the governor."
There was a chorus of laughter at this, but the tone was subdued. I turned back to my work, concentrating fiercely to blot out the picture of what was now happening on the field of war. War was bad enough, even when it was necessary. Cold-blooded revenge by the victor was one degree beyond. And yet, From Tryon's point of view, that might be necessary too. As battles went, this one had been both quick and relatively minor in terms of casualty. I had only 20 or so wounded in my keeping, and had seen only one fatality. There would be more elsewhere, of course, yet from the comments of those nearby, it had been a rout, but not a slaughter. The militia